Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Republican legislators pass a bill that weakens the governor's office again and one that requires sheriffs to cooperate with ICE. They also choose a new Speaker of the House. Locally, many in Charlotte's immigrant community brace for deportations under the Trump administration. Immigration lawyers are ramping up to defend them. The race between incumbent Democrat Allison Riggs and Republican Jefferson Griffin for a seat on the state Supreme Court shows Riggs ahead, but the vote is so close that Griffin has called for a recount. And the water is flowing again through the taps in Asheville. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE Executive Editor Eli Portillo. Nick Oxner is WBTV's Chief Investigative Reporter. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Ryan Pitkin is here. He's Editor-in-Chief of Queen City News. Good morning. Welcome to you all. Welcome back.
Morning.
Morning.
Morning. Morning.
It was a busy week at the legislature, to put it mildly, with a flurry of activity, much of it aimed at weakening the power of the governor yet again and allowing the soon-to-disappear Republican supermajority to flex its muscles. So let's start with their decision to override Governor Roy Cooper's veto of House Bill 10, which would make big changes to private school vouchers and to immigration enforcement. For years, Republicans have wanted sheriffs around the state to help ICE in their deportation efforts. Democratic sheriffs, for the most part, have resisted that attempt. But now that will be difficult, if not impossible. What does this bill require, Eli?
So basically, the bill does a few key things wrapped up together. On the immigration front, it requires local sheriff's offices in all 100 counties to comply with federal immigration detainer requests where someone is identified as being in the country illegally and ICE says, hold them for us. It also, as you mentioned, included private school voucher expansion to the tune of $6.5 billion. Over the next decade or so. And it also has some other sweeteners in it, like it has some, I think, $33 million in funding for child care center stabilization that was otherwise going to expire. So it wraps up a lot of changes that Republicans have wanted to pass in one package, and they passed it. They overrode the veto mostly along party lines, although they were joined by three Democrats in the House, including Mecklenburg County's Carla Cunningham.
So let's stick, at least initially, to the ICE portion of this bill. For the sheriffs, for years, these sheriffs, mostly Democratic sheriffs, have refused to comply with ICE and have said that doing so would destroy trust within the immigrant community, which would make those communities and communities at large less safe because they would be reluctant to interface with law enforcement, even when they needed to be protected by law enforcement. With a second Trump administration on the horizon, promising mass deportations, Anna Blackburn with the group Women Leading Together has a warning.
This bill will cause fear, will cause distrust among the community and law enforcement, will not allow women to report domestic violence when they need to due to fear. And a vote against the immigrant community is financially ludicrous for the state of North Carolina.
Now, she made these comments on the eve of the legislature's vote forcing sheriffs to comply. That vote to override the governor's veto passed largely along party lines, with Democratic Representative Carla Cunningham of Mecklenburg County joining Republicans, saying, quote, "We must adopt a common sense approach to public safety, ensuring that federal and local agencies work together to safeguard our communities." Was she expected, Nick, to cross the aisle?
You know, I she's not the go-to typical Democratic members that that you've seen vote with Republicans in the past. And so I don't know that I'd say this was a total shock, but it is maybe not what some folks would have expected.
And, you know, she faced a primary challenge and has been targeted by more left-wing elements of the Democrats. They've been unhappy with her for being a self-described centrist. She's, I think, shown some willingness, and there's probably a little bit of, you know, PTSD on the Democratic side after the Tricia Cotham switch, but she handily won her primary with 85% of the vote, and she talked with WFAE's Steve Harrison yesterday, and she basically said, you know, she wants to carve a position as a centrist, and this is one way to do it.
And that let me be clear, and Eli gave much more context to what I was trying to inartfully say, but there have been, in these eras of where Republicans have not quite super majorities, but long majorities, there have been over every iterations of the kind of go-to Democrats who would likely, maybe they vote for the budget, maybe they're going to vote for other things. Tricia Cotham was in that camp before she switched parties, right? And so, again, I'm not sure it was super surprising to see Representative, to see this happen now. Here, but you know, it is a new development, and she's clearly trying to signal, and you know, maybe she'll get herself some nice committee assignments with this for the next session. There are some advantages to taking a vote like this now, heading into the next session, where again, some of your quote centrist Democrats are going to be very useful and valuable to Republicans.
Republicans in the legislature have been trying to make this happen for quite a while now, and I guess this was their last hurrah because they lose their supermajority when the new legislature takes office. That doesn't mean they couldn't have passed it next time around, but this was a good time to do it, I guess. But Ryan, given what is likely to happen after January 20th, when the Trump administration comes into office and his promised mass deportations, was this really necessary?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think it was, because they're going to have to rely on local agencies to sort of help with this. A lot of the question around these Trump promises is not whether or not he is sincere in his desire to carry out these mass deportations. It's around whether his administration will have the capacity to do so, and what that will not only cost, but just the literal capacity of the people, the manpower to do it. And that's going to take, we're going to probably see more asking of local agencies to sort of play along, if that, for lack of a better term, in helping with the whatever this looks like. I don't know the details. You know, there's been all sorts of talk of what mass deportations look like, but I imagine it will involve local agencies, or at least a lot of requests or asks from local agencies.
If they are serious, and I think they are, about rounding up millions of people, then it will require all hands on deck, it seems to me. Let's stay with this for just a moment. Donald Trump has appointed a deportation czar, and he has promised to round up and deport millions of people who did not come here through proper channels. Some of these individuals have been given temporary protected status, which is referred to in shorthand as TPS, which Trump has threatened to revoke. Why have some of these immigrants been granted this status in the first place?
Well, Eli. In the case of one of the immigrants that Julian Berger, our immigration reporter at WFAE, spoke with, she's a Venezuelan who came here to study and gained TPS, temporary protected status, to continue working. Most TPS recipients, I believe all TPS recipients, are from countries that are unstable, that are dangerous, people who have a very good reason to flee, for example, Haiti, Venezuela, etc. And there's a big fear that if they are caught up in this, if TPS status is revoked or restricted, that they might be faced with going back to really unsafe conditions. And I think this shows how the threat of mass deportations is not only impacting people with no legal status, people who are, you know, in the country illegally, but people who are in the country under various legal statuses, they are also concerned, scared, and really bracing for their lives to be upended.
You mentioned our Julian Berger, WFAE's diversity, and I think give me his title, Eli.
He is a race and equity reporter covering immigration.
Okay. You mentioned he talked to this young Venezuelan woman who was on TPS status in the country. She came here in 2015. She preferred to remain anonymous, but she shared this with WFAE News.
The ending of TPS would mean my dream is over. What I worked so hard to legally accomplish would be over. Being here undocumented has never been my ideal scenario, and given the fight that the undocumented are going to experience in the coming year, I wouldn't want to be in that position either.
Help me out here, Eli, because she has TPS status. Is she officially undocumented? She came here on a student visa. They gave her status after she graduated. She stays. She's worked. She is working right now.
Yes, I
Why is she
believe what,
undocumented?
well, she is not saying she is undocumented at the moment. I believe what she is saying is if TPS status were to be revoked for people
Okay.
from Venezuela, she would be faced with a stark choice of trying to stay in the country where she's built a life as an undocumented immigrant at that point.
Does anybody know how many people who have TPS status are facing this possible revocation of that status? Do we have any idea how many people in this country have that status right now?
I don't know the
Okay.
exact number. I do know large numbers of people, particularly from Venezuela and Haiti, have gained that status. And you saw it become a big issue, of course, in Springfield, Ohio, during the campaign when the whole, they're eating the pets thing
Right.
happened, which was not true. That was about a community of Haitian immigrants who had TPS, and that was how they had moved to Springfield.
And our
I'm
Julie
seeing
Bird.
1.2 million from Pew Research Center. Just a
Really?
quick search.
Okay. Our Julian Berger also reports that many in the Charlotte immigration community are bracing for deportations, and immigration lawyers are gearing up their legal services to help them. There are so many questions here, like, will there be sufficient numbers of attorneys around the country to jump in and help? Will they have sufficient time to plead their cases before these people are rounded up and then quickly deported if they can do it quickly enough? Do we have any answers? Do we have any idea what that process is going to be like, might be like?
Well, President-elect Trump has indicated he would want to use the military to supplement manpower shortages. We know that sheriffs will be required to comply with ICE detainers. So there's a lot of fear. I think Tom Homan, the new head of this initiative, has said that they want to bring back workplace raids, construction sites, restaurants, places where there might be undocumented workers. And what immigrant advocates here in Charlotte are doing is trying to educate the community. There's an estimated 58,000 undocumented immigrants in Mecklenburg County. They're trying to educate them about their rights if they are detained, how to interact with ICE or other officers, how to request legal help. So right now, everyone's kind of braced and wait and see is the sense that we've gotten.
Yeah, there are 58,000 undocumented immigrants living in Mecklenburg County, about 325,000 throughout the state. And during the roundups that occurred in the first Trump administration, the Carolina Migrant Network recruited volunteers to patrol neighborhoods to confirm sightings of ICE and then use social media to distribute information about where these people were to the community. They say they don't plan. They don't plan to reinstitute that program this time, however. Why?
I think I don't know how effective it was. I think it can also stoke a lot of fear. I don't want to speculate too much, but if you look at social media, there's a lot of misinformation that spreads really quickly. So I think you could have a lot of fear about, hey, ICE officers are sighted here, or stay away from this and maybe not have a benefit.
Okay. When we come back, a couple of more questions about this deportation plan and how it might affect us monetarily. And then we'll move on to other things that the legislature was very busy with this week, including overriding the school voucher veto by the governor and further weakening the governor's office, something that has been ongoing for several years now. We're here with Eli Portillo, Alexandria Sands, Nick Oxner, and Ryan Pitkin. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Eli Portillo joins us from WFAE News. Nick Oxner from WBTV. Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve and Alexandria Sands from Axios Charlotte. Before we move on, the cost of deporting even a million undocumented people around the country will set us back by about, I'm told, $88 billion. Over 10 years, $88 billion for a million people. And there are a lot more than that that they intend to deport. And when asked if the country could afford that, Trump's new border czar, Tom Homan, asked back, what price do you put on security? And then there will be the cost to the economy if they are successful in deporting these folks who are farm workers, hospitality industry workers, others in the service sector, most of whom pay payroll taxes, but don't reap the benefits of those taxes. And Social Security and Medicare also already face shortfalls, and they're pumping money into those funds. Given that reality, is there reason to believe that the incoming administration might hold back or scale back some of their goals once reality sets in?
Not really. They'll
be forced to. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Nick.
Well, I think we said different versions of the exact same thing. But, you know, I don't think they're going to scale back. I think the only place we will see some leniency on immigrants is in the tech sector. I think you could tie that probably most closely to Donald Trump's cozy relationship with Elon Musk and some openness from other parts of Silicon Valley to Donald Trump and these advanced workers with high tech skills and knowledge. But there has not yet seemed to be a large recognition of the importance that immigrants play towards farm labor and construction labor, both of which are two vital pillars of the U.S. economy.
Ryan, do you want to chime in?
I think that there's some other infrastructural things that I'm curious as to, I don't see any solutions to in terms of, we don't really have diplomatic relationships with countries like Venezuela where we're able to just ship people there. And I don't mean to dehumanize and just talk about them as if they're pawns. There is a very human aspect to this, but it's just not as easy as what they've been doing in Texas in terms of putting people on buses and shipping them to democratic cities. This is country to country diplomacy, and my fear is that it'll just lead to detainment, incarceration that stays on American soil and is nothing comes of it. It's not deportations as much as it's incarceration because we don't have anywhere to send folks.
These countries don't have to accept the people that we put on airplanes and send to them. Okay, back in Raleigh and our legislature's busyness overriding gubernatorial vetoes this week, they successfully override the governor's veto on the expansion of opportunity scholarships or the school voucher program. This was also part of House Bill 10, which we spoke about, and would provide $463 million to clear the opportunity scholarship backlog and provide funding for families to continue to attend private schools. Democrats certainly are opposed to this, saying that this extra money should instead fund the public schools. The only senator to debate the bill, however, was Mecklenburg County's Natasha Marcus.
This is not a bill about helping low-income families or even about school choice. This is about expanding the program to the wealthiest families in our state.
But Representative Tricia Cotham sees this as a way for parents to avoid sending their children to our, quote, failing public schools. The Raleigh News and Observer has pointed out that in her criticisms of the public schools, she made some incorrect statements. Alex, what did she say?
She was saying that children were trapped in these schools and that they were failing them and that this was going to give them the opportunity to seek out something else, another option. I do not know it was inaccurate. I don't know. Maybe Eli knows that.
I do.
She said
that the predominant number of schools, public schools in the state, get D and F grades, and that most of the families seeking these scholarships fall into the lowest socioeconomic income brackets. The truth is that most public schools in the state have C grades. That's woeful, but nonetheless, it's not an F, it's a C, with nearly 30% of them having A grades. And once the voucher program is expanded, the largest number of beneficiaries will be from higher income families. There you go. That's what's controversial, and that's what's untrue that she said. $463 million is a lot of money. And although supporters of school vouchers are celebrating, Mecklenburg Senator Natasha Marcus once again called this expansion fiscally irresponsible.
This is a budget-busting expense that more than doubles the already significant voucher program in North Carolina. The Office of State Budget and Management has forecasted a budget shortfall in the near future.
Eli, is she right? Why are they forecasting a shortfall in this economy?
Well, I think that there are going to be a lot of higher expenses continuing for, you know, everything from personnel costs and healthcare, inflation, insurance, etc. So, I mean, costs continue to go up. At the same time, the Republicans in the General Assembly have been saying, look, we have a surplus. We've squirreled away a rainy day fund. We are bringing in more money right now, so we have money to spend. I think that, you know, Natasha Marcus and opponents of the school choice vouchers program, they wouldn't say, hey, don't spend this $6.5 billion. You know, they would say, spend it on public schools and doing things like increasing teacher pay. So I think that really, when you get down to it, I mean, it's not a question of should we spend or not spend this money at the state. It's what should we spend it on?
Yeah. In fact, Governor Cooper has said, you know, said basically exactly that before this veto is overridden. Stop, you know, spend, put that money into hurricane recovery, for instance, among other things, what he called on instead of passing these vouchers. But yeah, let's be very clear, just like we rightfully called out, you know, these factual and logical errors from Representative Cotham here. Let's also talk about, you know, calling this a budget busting provision. It just isn't true. It's not budget busting. In the North Carolina budget, where we've run ahead above projected surpluses just about every quarter for the last, I mean, like 4 years probably. So North Carolina is not at risk of a budget deficit. By law, North Carolina has to have a balanced budget. And there's been no credible, projection, no credible claim that we're at a deficit. And so she may have meant this is big, but there is no budget buster.
Okay, the legislature also took up a bill addressing the recovery needs from Hurricane Helene. It contained a wide-ranging overhaul of executive branch power as well, which led to loud protests from citizens watching from the Senate gallery and a call by Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who was presiding over the Senate at the time, to have those rabble-rousers removed.
Mr. President, these are the people of North
this
Carolina.
This is the people's house.
President, I move that we take a 10-minute recess.
Mr. President, we have...
The Senate will stand in recess for 10 minutes while these immature people are taken out.
These immature people were protesting what some of them called a power grab by legislators. Okay, what does this bill do?
This bill was kind of pitched as a hurricane recovery fund bill to send $227 million to that effort. But it included a lot of things that would take power away from the Democrats who are about to take office, Josh Stein as governor, probably being the biggest one people are really concerned about. He won't be able to appoint three members to the Board of Elections anymore. Instead, they're going to give that power to the auditor. So the auditor is going to be Republican come January. So the governor is not going to be able to do that. The auditor will probably appoint three Republicans, and then there are two other members, so the majority of that board will now basically guaranteed be Republican.
So you are parroting precisely what Democrats on the floor of that Senate had to say. Democratic Representative Lindsey Prather derided the bill for doing little in terms of hurricane relief, despite the $227 million it puts forward, and characterized this way.
This is a transparent power grab pushed through by a supermajority that's not happy with the recent election results, and you're calling it a disaster relief bill.
And Senate Democratic Leader Dan Blue also called his Republican colleagues out.
You're punishing North Carolinians for voting you out of power, and you're using Hurricane Helene as a distraction to cover those tracks. It's cynical, it's unconstitutional, and it's just plain wrong.
This is part of a pattern in recent years of the legislature removing power from the governor's office, no matter the party of the governor. They did this when Pat McCrory was in office to a certain degree. But in this case, the incoming governor, Josh Stein, is a Democrat, as are many of the other executive branch members that voters said yes to. What will he not be able to do as a result of this, Nick, that Governor Cooper has been able to do?
I think the biggest thing is moving control of the State Board of Elections. And let's be clear, there's not a ton they can do more, mostly because they've taken all the powers they can. And what you'll also notice is they didn't move the powers to themselves because courts have already said they can't do that after they tried to do that to Pat McCrory. And then later in a different version, they tried to do it to Governor Cooper. Now they've moved it to another council state member, so another executive agency. And so, you know, this will undoubtedly head to court. I'd be really curious to see if it stands. Let's also not forget why the state Supreme Court race that we talked about last week is being razor thin, and it's still razor thin, but less so, wider razor. This week matters, right? Because this will go up to probably a state Supreme Court that is controlled by Republicans. And so, you know, we should note, Mike, this didn't just start with Phil Berger taking control as the Senate leader in 2010 when Republicans took over. This is something, a time-honored tradition that dated back well before him to when Mark Bassnight was in Phil Berger's job and he was taking away executive powers from the Democratic governor as a Democrat.
Go ahead, Ryan. Go ahead.
No, I just thought it was important to mention that, you know, so a lot of those clips were Democrats, but there's also some Republicans here who voted against this. And they'll play a major role. Three from Western North Carolina. Mark Pless was quoted as saying this bill appears to do nothing for Western North Carolina. And that's important to note just because it'll play into whether Governor Cooper does veto or not, because that's the whole politics of calling it a Hurricane Helene bill. And they can say, oh, you voted against relief, despite people saying there's not really any new relief. And then if he does veto, then it'll take folks like Mark Pless and those Republicans who voted against it. Now they're saying they're going to read it more in depth because it was sort of fast-tracked, and that'll play into whether or not they override said veto. So there's a lot of politics. I mean, obviously that's the point, but there's just a lot going into what happens in the next week or two.
Mark Pless is from Haywood County. That's in Western North Carolina. You mentioned that two other Republicans voted no on this. They, too, are from Western North Carolina. The money that is part of this, the $227 million, is for hurricane relief efforts in the western part of the state. Here's what Haywood County Republican Mark Pless had to say.
I am not going to vote for something that when I get home and go to the grocery store at 9 o'clock the next morning, that if someone asks, I can't explain what I did and what the bill's going to do. And this bill here, there was no way to do that.
What is behind this? If the legislature, Nick, does not directly benefit from this so-called power grab because the courts have said you can't, so they have to give that power to someone else, what's behind it? What's the impetus? Why do it?
Well, as Alex pointed out, they've now moved power to a job that come January will be occupied by a Republican. I think if that changes 4 years from now, the Republicans probably feel pretty good about their ability to change it to a different office later. You know, I think this is a test to see if this will hold up in court. And I don't know that it will. It might. Especially when, you know, given the number of seats that the Republicans control in the state Supreme Court, might hold up in court. We'll see. But I think this is a test.
Okay. Eli?
Yeah. And I think it's also worth noting that, you know, they've restricted the attorney general's ability to intervene in lawsuits in ways that are contrary to the position of legislative leaders. You know, Josh Stein, the incoming governor, was attorney general, and this was a major point of contention between him and the legislature over the years when it came to defending or opposing positions, since obviously they were different positions, opposite positions a lot of the time. Jeff Jackson, the incoming attorney general, of course, is also a Democrat. So I think that that's another aspect of it, too. You've got the legislature, legislative supermajority going out, and I think they're in some ways doing a little unfinished business at the end here with Josh Stein and his successor.
Nick.
We should point out, Mike, since we're calling out legislative hyperbole and euphemisms today, that this was referred to by Republicans in their headline as good governance reforms, which was really just shifting power around Raleigh.
So the bill impacts the incoming governor. It impacts the incoming lieutenant governor. It impacts Jeff Jackson, the incoming attorney general. In some ways, impacts the new Democratic superintendent of public instruction, Mo Green. In fact, these are all Democrats. One thing in particular sticks out. The bill would restrict the attorney general's ability to participate in lawsuits. I think you referenced that a moment ago. Namely, where the action by the legislature is being challenged in court. He couldn't go in there and take the other side. It would also remove the superintendent of public instruction's ability to appeal decisions made by the board overseeing charter schools. So they want to minimize the effectiveness of the entire executive branch. Is that constitutional?
We will find out. And look, the charter school thing is a thing that has happened under current Republican superintendent of public instruction, Catherine Truitt. This is just the next evolution in that. And came, by the way, in as part of a controversy involving some charter schools on whose boards current Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson's wife sits. So again, none of this is new. None of these efforts are new. These are just the latest efforts. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying none of this is new and shouldn't come as a shock to us here.
So this bill also contains a provision that would require county election boards to finish counting mail-in and provisional ballots more quickly following Election Day, something the Democrats have called impractical, and which would force understaffed election workers to work around the clock or risk throwing out valid ballots. This now goes to the governor for his signature. Is he likely to veto it, and would it matter if he did? I have just seconds.
Yes and no.
We'll come back to that then, because we have to stop. Well, I think we do. No, we got 30 seconds. Yes and no what?
Yes, he'll veto. No, it won't matter because it's going to get overridden by this last-ditch majority.
Okay, now we know. When we come back, we'll talk about Tom Tillis, because he, too, is talking about Hurricane Helene relief efforts, but he's doing it in the United States Senate, and they also, the legislature, will go back to the legislature because they're very busy this week. They elected a new Speaker of the House to replace Tim Moore, who is going to Washington. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, the local news roundup with Eli Portillo, executive editor of WFAE News, Nick Oxner, chief investigative reporter for WBTV, Ryan Pitkin, the editor-in-chief of Queen City Nerve, and Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis took the need for Hurricane Helene relief funding to Capitol Hill, where he made an urgent and emotional plea.
102 lives lost. 151 homes destroyed. 500,000 businesses affected in disaster-declared areas. 5,000 miles of road. This is North Carolina statistics, ladies and gentlemen. 5,000 miles of road, including almost 5 miles of I-40, damaged and impassable for likely a couple of years.
He went on to say that this disaster should be compared to the COVID-19 pandemic. He had earlier asked the Senate to pass an appropriation by unanimous consent, but it was blocked by Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. Eli, why?
Well, essentially, excuse me, Rand Paul's not a fan of more government spending, and and I think insinuated it would be wasteful spending. And, you know, one issue is that the state legislature here in North Carolina has said, you know, they want to see how much federal relief money is coming and what that's going to look like before spending more of the rainy day fund that the legislature has. I thought one thing that was interesting to point out from Tillis's plea was the focus on business recovery. That's been a theme that we've heard for a while now. Obviously, the human life losses and the disruption to people's houses and, you know, just their lives is huge. But I think people are starting to really worry in some of the hardest hit areas about what does it mean when the businesses are not able to return, when people start moving away in search of other work, when sort of that longer term infrastructure that enables a region to be economically viable is lost. So I thought that that emphasis on the SBA loans and the effect on businesses was noteworthy.
So we are about to see a political changeover in Washington. Obviously, the Senate will switch hands from Democrat to Republican. It is likely that I think it's settled now that the House will be also controlled by Republicans. And of course, the White House will be controlled by Republicans. And Tom Tillis is our senior Republican senator. He was asked by CNN this week on Capitol Hill about Donald Trump's plan to bypass the Senate, or his request of the Senate to bypass that body and install cabinet officials through recess appointments.
That should be absolutely off the table. And quite honestly, any serious candidate for a cabinet level position, I would have to really wonder if they would want it or be willing to accept it under a recess appointment. These positions are too important and carry too much weight internationally to take a shortcut.
I'm just wondering if this signals some sort of spine strengthening in the United States Senate. They are a co-equal branch of government. But so far, in recent years, they've kind of buckled to the whims of Donald Trump. Yesterday, Matt Gaetz withdrew his nomination, and he didn't do it voluntarily. He did it because he didn't have the votes in the Senate for confirmation as Attorney General. And there are other cabinet appointments that Donald Trump has made that some people, including Republicans in the Senate, have trouble with. Are we witnessing, perhaps, at least an attempt for them to exercise their obligation under the Constitution, or will this too weaken and go away over time?
I think we found the line maybe with Matt Gaetz, right? And keep in mind, Matt Gaetz is a now former member of Congress who was fairly deeply unpopular within his own caucus within the House, right? And was also, you know, had been investigated for years at this point on allegations that he had sexual relations with underage women. So I think we have found the line in Matt Gaetz. But, you know, meanwhile, his Secretary of Defense nominee, Pete Hegseth, who arguably equally unorthodox of a pick, is receiving a warmer reception in the Senate. I don't know that I'd say it's on fire, but it's not Matt Gaetz cold. So I think Matt Gaetz was the lie.
Okay. Back to Raleigh again, because with House Speaker Republican Tim Moore departing for a seat in Congress in the U.S. House, General Assembly House members elected a new speaker, Alex. His name is Destin Hall. I think that was my dorm in college. Destin Hall, what do we know about him?
He's an attorney. He's from Caldwell County. He's 37, so pretty young. He's in his fourth term in the House, and he's had some influence. He's been the Rules Committee chair, and that's a pretty influential role. So, you know, they manage how the legislation gets into the chamber and how it flows. But we've known this for a while, that he was probably going to be their pick and to succeed Tim Moore, and he's had Tim Moore's blessing, so...
And he was elected without opposition. So this has been, why him? He, as you say, this has been in the pipeline, in the works for a while. I think probably when Tim Moore decided he wanted to run for Congress, he kind of maybe picked his own successor. Why him?
Obviously, he stood out. It was between him and John Bell. They're both kind of campaigning for the role, and they struck a deal that Bell was going to be the he was going to take on another role, and Dustin Hall was going to go for the House Speaker.
That Bell is now going to become the rules chair, just to be very specific, which is the role that Hall had previously.
Yes, thank you, Nick.
So Destin Hall is from Lenoir, and his campaign website says he will, quote, make sure our voice is heard by advocating for lower taxes, economic development, strengthening our education system, and continue to work to protect our religious liberties, our Second Amendment rights, and the right to life for the unborn. That sounds like boilerplate Republican, but he's also described as having a different kind of leadership from that of Tim Moore. What does that mean?
I think Tim Moore, especially in the last probably two sessions, maybe longer, has ruled with a little bit of I'm in charge and I need this done, so you're going to get it done, within his own caucus. Mm-hmm. I don't think Representative Hall has that kind of approach, nor do I think he has the kind of power, at least not yet, that you have to be able to do that as well. So I think you're going to see a caucus in the House with members who are more who feel more that leadership is more approachable and able to get things done.
Eli.
I just wanted to note that I've passed the event horizon where I'm older than the leader of the North Carolina House now. So personally,
gets worse.
Yeah, personally for me, it's a disturbing event.
Thrilled to be 35 and still younger than the House Speaker. Well, but it is just too close to comfort, to your point.
Well, you're now old enough then to run for president. Allison Riggs is one of only two Democrats on the North Carolina State Supreme Court. Her race for re-election against Republican Jefferson Griffin, very tight. As the votes were counted, Griffin was ahead initially by about 10,000 votes. Once they finished counting the ballots, I think he was behind by 625 votes. And she then claimed victory, but Griffin called for a recount, and the State Board of Elections granted that request. On Monday, Riggs was just ahead by 24 votes. When might we know the final outcome of this race?
Now the margin is 625 as of the last count, and, you know, it'll take a few, I believe, by next week they'll finish the machine recount. What's going to make it likely take a little longer is that Jefferson Griffin has challenged about 60,000 provisional ballots and other ballots that might have had issues. He and the Republican Party have raised issues about handling ballots and whether they have access to lists of felons and people who might have voted in person but also absentee. A lot of the same election integrity issues you've seen raised. So I think that challenge will make it take longer than the recount itself, and, you know, could well be headed to litigation.
Wow. So even if the recount puts one or the other ahead, let's say he wins the recount, would she then challenge the recount?
Well, undoubtedly.
Yes. And, you know, I think it's also worth noting that, you know, in 2020, Sherry Beasley lost her seat on the Supreme Court to Chief Justice Paul Newby by about 400 votes. She asked for a recount. It didn't change anything. So the recount itself is not very likely to change the outcome or significantly change the vote number. That's just really not what happens with these machine recounts.
What's the challenge likely to produce, the 60,000 votes that he's challenging?
Probably the same result, except let's also remember that the Republicans hold a majority on the state Supreme Court that could be an ultimate arbiter over any of these squabbles, and that's why this seat matters.
Would she have to recuse herself from a decision in that case? Because she's on the court.
Undoubtedly. Yes.
Okay. With House Speaker Republican Tim Moore. We've already done that story. Let's do this one. Affordable housing.
Do it again.
Let's do it again. Yeah. Affordable housing, workforce housing for workers, for people in jobs like police and firefighting and teachers is in short supply. We've talked about this ad nauseum. So now CMS, Alex, is branching into the home construction business in an effort to retain teachers. Is this idea unique to Charlotte, or are other communities around the country engaging in this?
No, we're definitely seeing this all over the country. Even CMS leaders said that they had traveled to California recently just to see what they were doing with some of their own teacher housing complexes. It's in Atlanta too. It's in Austin, so it's not unique. It's just the point we've reached in this country with the housing affordability crisis and the
Well,
teacher shortage coming together.
maybe you don't know the answer to this question, but clearly, if workforce housing is needed, it's not just teachers who need it. We already mentioned police officers, firefighters, service workers, people who give you your hamburger at McDonald's probably need this. Why are the teachers getting this treatment?
Well, I mean, it's the low pay, but also just the teachers fleeing the workforce. It doesn't seem like there's much hope for them to move up in their roles or to make more money, where possibly police officers might see different routes.
Okay.
Teachers kind of see themselves as doing charity at this point, or supporting their own.
Board of Education member Monty Witherspoon outlined the problem this way.
We have teacher needs that are very, very difficult for us to fill. When you look at a solution like this for individuals who work two and three jobs, and I'm not doing this just for grandstanding, we have homeless teachers. And I want people to be aware of that. That's a true statement.
Are people aware that I wasn't aware that we have homeless teachers?
I don't know. I've never met a homeless teacher, but I'm sure there are teachers who are having a really hard time making ends meet, and definitely teachers who are living with multiple roommates and they can't afford to live on their own, especially in the city limits.
So CMS wants to build a $30 million educator community on district-owned land that would also include 100 retail units and common spaces. Are we talking about a dormitory for teachers? Are these apartments? Are these single-family homes? Are these townhouses? What are they?
There's really not much of a plan right now. They said that they're going to use 2025 as the year to finalize the plans, but that's how it's been described right now, is around 100 units and some common spaces. That's, I guess, the vision that they are going with.
And part of this is due to the increasing need not only to attract but to retain teachers. 61% of teachers say housing may impact whether they continue to work at CMS. A starting North Carolina teacher makes $41,000 a year. Mecklenburg County supplements that with an additional $7,600, taking it to just under $50,000. But the average sales price of a home in Charlotte is $577,745. Probably not affordable. And rents here are high too. Would these CMS homes be permanently affordable? Would they move them up and down according to market rate? Do we have any idea how they intend to do this?
I don't think that they have any of those answers yet. I think that's what they need to flesh out. And I think there's also going to be a lot of questions about how do you pick the 100 or so teachers who get to live here, because the demand is probably going to be much higher than that. And I know that they're already saying that hopefully when they create this teacher community, this is something that they can replicate, because they know that there's going to need to be more than one.
Interestingly enough, WCNC-TV reports that some CMS teachers have suggested the idea of teacher housing community is offensive because it doesn't address the overarching salary issue. People around Asheville, Eli, we have very short on time, but they have just gotten their water back. It's been off for 53 days, 7 weeks, something like that. They just got it back. What took so long?
The water pipes themselves were destroyed, miles and miles of pipes that brought water from, the reservoirs and the treatment plants. So just a massive rebuilding program. I think that this is really important, again, not just for people's lives, but also for the tourism and other industries that help sustain a lot of Asheville. It's hard to convince people to come back if you don't have drinkable water in your taps.
And it was also reported this week that the North Carolina agency tasked with the state's storm recovery efforts is short of money. It's called NC Build, I think, or Rebuild NC. And then Laura Hogshead left her position as head of that agency this week, primarily because of a lack of response to hurricanes that took place 5 to 7 years ago, Florence and Matthew, that destroyed parts of the eastern part of the state. And recovery efforts in the western part of the state have been plagued with mis and disinformation. This week, a video surfaced from an Appalachian prepper on TikTok about the Red Cross in the western part of the state.
Families staying in these shelters are being told if you don't have a safe place to take your children, you won't be leaving with them. The authorities will keep them. I need you to share, repost, and watch this whole video. These families need our help.
We want to tell you that that is not true. None of that is true. And WFAE and Paul Specht with the WRAL fact check this. So that is completely false, right, Eli?
Yes, and it's been viewed millions of times.
So we played it so we could tell you it is not true. Eli Portillo from WFAE, Nick Oxen from WBTV, Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve, and Alexandria Sands from Axios. Thanks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.